Funding for Think comes from SMU's informal courses for adults.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does carbon do for us, and what is it likely to do to us and our fragile environment if its release into the atmosphere as CO2 continues unabated? Science and technology writer Eric Rosten spent a long time considering these questions and concluded that although we talk about carbon in its various iterations, carbohydrates in carbonated beverages, carbon fiber in aircraft and Kevlar vests, and of course the carbon dioxide emissions that are heating the planet at an unprecedented rate, most of us don't know all that much about it. His new book takes a fresh look at carbon's properties as they relate to our lives and our world. It's called The Carbon Age: How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. Eric, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. I'm glad to be here.
You write, the fastest way to learn about the world is through the carbon atom. What's so special about it?
Carbon is basically, I think of it as atomic Velcro. And think about what Velcro does is it holds something together and then it releases it. And that's really the magic of carbon. It's this atomic sweet spot that can hold things together, like the beautiful double helix of our DNA, which is 70 or 80% carbon. But it also knows when to let go, as it does in carbohydrates or gasoline or even TNT, which is based on the reactivity of carbon with nitrogen and oxygen.
Yeah, what's great about that metaphor is that you say Velcro and not superglue, because carbon, as you write, is not extreme in really any of its properties.
That's true. If you want, there's a 100-year-old science fiction question of, can life is based on carbon. Could you have life based on silicon? Well, the answer is really no, for the reason you point out, which is that silicon is a little closer to superglue because sand is silicon dioxide. It's inert. Not a lot you can do with it. You make a sandcastle, but not inhabitants for it.
Aside from the climate change condition, at least for a moment, we quite literally live and die by carbon and always have. Can you talk about that cycle?
Certainly. There are really two cycles, and one of the things I try to focus on in the carbon age is how they've sort of collapsed together into one as a result of industrial activity. There's the short-term carbon cycle, which we think of as the biosphere, which can last from nanoseconds to hundreds or thousands of years, and this is the flow of cycle through organisms, through the air, into the water, into the soil, back into life, and the respiration and photosynthesis cycle of animals and plants. There's also what geologists call the long-term carbon cycle, and that includes the Earth's mineral and deposits and rocks, and that's a much longer cycle, maybe. It could take a carbon atom 200 or 300 million years to complete the cycle of going from a volcano into the atmosphere, through life, back down into sediment and rock, and up the volcano again. And one way to frame global warming, actually, is, and the book isn't really about global warming, because there's a lot of great books about global warming. I wanted to get at something more fundamental. But we're basically accelerating the long-term carbon cycle onto a short-term path. So a geological time and biological time for the first time ever, as far as we know, are collapsing into the same thing.
One fascinating point that you make that we should know, but it's easy to forget, is that the Earth and its atmosphere are essentially a closed material system. So it's not that we're creating carbon where none ever existed before, but our activities are causing molecules that, in other words, carbon combines with other elements, and those have really different properties than carbon alone.
That's an extremely important point. I was interviewing a professor at MIT, and he actually said, you know, the simplest thing they might be able to get people to understand global warming is the law of conservation of matter on Earth. And we were taking carbon minerals underground, and we're moving them. We're turning them into atmospheric gas, and it doesn't disappear when fuel doesn't disappear when it goes into your engine and burns. It combines with oxygen and becomes a gas. Just because we don't see it doesn't mean it's not out there anymore. And we are seeing it in the form of increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere.
Yeah, you write about this great sort of experiment of the disappearing diamond. Can you talk about that?
One of the things that's sort of interesting to think about is scientists have known since 1780, they learned that respiration and combustion are the same thing. But they know for even longer before that that carbon, ostensibly, are compounds that burn. And Antoine Lavoisier was the father of modern chemistry, and he funded his own research because he had money. And one of the things he did was burn a diamond. There was, at that time, a century-old scientific question of what diamonds are made of. Even Isaac Newton had weighed in and said, well, it could be some sort of congealed oil or something. And Lavoisier burned a diamond, and he burned basically a lump of coal, lump of charcoal, and the gas that resulted from the burning of each was the same. So he concluded tentatively, because he thought it was an insane idea, that the diamonds are actually made of carbon. And, of course, about 40 years later, some British scientists proved that to be true.
No telling what his wife thought of the experiment. Eric Roston is my guest. He's a science and technology writer whose new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. I was fascinated to read, Eric, that the universe has not always contained carbon. What happened to create it?
It's true. It's if you want to, the history of the universe and the history of its elements, carbon in particular, are not synonymous. The Big Bang did not create carbon. The Big Bang created hydrogen, and in the early moments of the universe, hydrogen fused into helium and some lithium, and that was about it for several hundred million years until the first major stars formed, and this is what cosmologists tell us, and that it's in stars that heavier elements form. And carbon forms in stars. It formed in those first stars, and it forms today in stars about 20% larger than our sun through the fusion of three helium atoms. And some of the stories of the discovery of this in the 1950s are some of the greatest gifts to science historians. Just huge egos and big fights, but that's where it comes from. The atomic the elements are basically the nuclear waste, if you want, of star fusion.
How much carbon exists in the universe?
Carbon is the fourth most abundant element in the universe. I think it's something on the order of magnitude of 0.03%. The overwhelming majority of the universe is, well, nothing. But in terms of the chemical elements that we know of are hydrogen, it's the most plentiful, and then helium, and then oxygen, and then carbon.
And where is it found, sort of stored most readily on Earth?
It's one of the funny things about carbon is life is based on it. I'm sitting here. My desk is made of wood, which is just about all carbon. My computer casing is made of plastic, which is just about all carbon. So it's everywhere in our lives, in ourselves, in our bodies. But it's actually a fairly rare element on Earth. So even though it's the core structural element of life, it's only, depending on the study you look at, it's only the 11th or 15th most abundant element in the Earth's crust in general. Well, the Earth is basically a ball of oxygen and silicon.
So how did carbon influence the evolution of life and the conditions on Earth and vice versa?
Evolution and life and the global carbon cycle have always been symbiotic, so that life has always both driven and been driven by the flow of carbon. And of course, the Earth's temperature is influenced greatly by the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, too. So, you know, one thing that's kind of interesting about our modern warming is that is the rate of the warming, because the actual notion that living things could influence the atmosphere is just a standard notion within geology. And for the first 2 billion years of life on Earth, so about maybe half of life's history, there was actually very little or no oxygen in the atmosphere. And then about 2.5 billion years ago, scientists reading the rock record see that that a new kind of life emerged, a new kind of bacterium that was able to take carbon out of the atmosphere and take electrons from water and release oxygen. And the oxygenation of the atmosphere is just a seminal event in geological history that was brought on by this evolutionary innovation and totally changed the atmosphere and the conditions for life on Earth forever.
So once the atmosphere changed, then other life forms that relied more on oxygen could evolve and thrive.
That's absolutely true, and it took a long time after that before you get animal life. But that oxygen, and they're actually carbon and oxygen, I think of as sort of the Lennon and McCartney of the periodic table, and that you know their ensemble work is much more interesting than their solo work. And once you have oxygen in the atmosphere, it can organisms were able to harness the power of oxygen with the structural genius of carbon, and you get more complex life forms as the fossil record proceeds.
So we know, Eric, that we breathe in oxygen and we breathe out carbon dioxide. Do those two things have any impact on the concentrations of the other?
They absolutely do, and this is a scientific point. I find it to be an instructive one, but that as we're burning fossil fuels, the oxygen content of the atmosphere is quantitatively diminishing. It's not like we're going to run out of oxygen. It's not like we're even going to be in a nearly restricted oxygen environment. But it does prove the point that the O2 in CO2 has got to come from somewhere. So for every carbon atom we're pulling out of the ground as coal, oil, or gas, or as food, as corn or meat or whatever we're munching on, that's rejoining the atmosphere with the molecule of oxygen.
Forgive me for asking a dumb question, but if we're in this sort of feedback loop and we keep increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, how do we know we won't ever get to a point where there's not enough oxygen?
Because oxygen is the second most abundant atmospheric gas, and there's if you just look at the orders of magnitude, and first of all, it's not a naive question. It's a perfectly logical question. The atmosphere is about 21% oxygen, and about 380 or 387 parts per million of carbon dioxide. So we're adding carbon on the order of millionths of a unit of air, when one out of every five molecules of air is oxygen. So there's just really no comparison in the numbers.
Eric Roston is my guest. He's a science and technology writer. His new book is called The Carbon Age: How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. We'll talk more about how carbon acts in our atmosphere, in our bodies, and in the products that we use after this break. You can also join our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Eric Rosten is my guest. He's a science and technology writer who worked for several years for Time magazine. His new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. If you want to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Eric, other than fuel, what are the most common commercial applications for carbon today?
Plastic, in a word. The plastics are largely petrochemicals or made from natural gas, and the ubiquity of these materials, you know, just say plastic to yourself every time you touch or see plastic during the day. And the plastics age really, I suppose, began probably in the 1950s. It just canonically, that's when the Nobel Foundation gave an award, a Nobel Prize, to a chemist who had developed industrial polymer chemistry. And it's really, you know, that's the first one that comes to mind. You know, wood has is mostly carbon. And, you know, in fact, the geological era when see the rise of trees for the first time is marked by this enormous drawdown of carbon from the atmosphere, and that's what, you know, that's what wood is. Wood is largely carbon, so it really is everywhere, and not only the structural material of our bodies, but we've turned these carbon materials into the structural material of our lifestyle.
Do all of these items that use carbon also generate carbon in waste form that is harmful?
It's hard to say categorically. For example, I have a chapter in the Carbon Age. Chapter 9 is about ballistics and bulletproof vests, and this was a really fun chapter. Very surprising that this emerged out of the research. And in the exchange between a gunshot and the stopping of a bullet by a bullet-resistant vest, you sort of see, you know, what I was talking about in the first part of our conversation about the explosive nature of carbon and its ability to let go of bonds in the gunpowder, and its ability to hold things together as it holds together those fibers in the chest. And Kevlar, which has been one of the leading anti-ballistic technologies for a long time, you know, you need a lot of sulfuric acid to make Kevlar, there are the federal government, state governments have very stringent ways of handling that kind of material, we can have all of these great industrial products with what governments have decided is a reasonable degree of security from pollution.
I don't want to get too far off course here, but one of the interesting problems they had to solve in making Kevlar vests was to find out how to align those carbon fibers so that they didn't tangle up like spaghetti and they would actually sort of lie flat and protect someone.
Yeah, that's there's a really neat way of thinking about this. This is one of the reasons why this was such a neat chapter to work on, because there's just something fundamental and universal in just the chemistry of Kevlar, this DuPont product, that is analogous to lightning, and it's analogous to hurricanes, and that is the answer to the question: why do we see order in the world? You know, hurricanes emerge from a pressure gradient, temperature gradients in the atmosphere, and a hurricane is the way that the Earth equalizes the temperature and pressure in different parts of the atmosphere. A lightning bolt is the way that nature equalizes the polarity at the top of the atmosphere and the bottom. And some origin of life chemists, these are chemists who study plausible conditions. There's no real evidence for the origin of life, which is sort of a problem. But they say, you know what? Well, maybe life emerged as just a way of equalizing chemical energy between the gradient that exists between the highest energy carbon molecule, which is methane, and carbon dioxide, which is the least energetic carbon molecule.
Because so, at the base of all life are molecules which don't live. They just contain atoms, and they are things that shouldn't have any life.
Yeah, well, that's true. Molecules are not alive, and that's one of the the big things that'll really cook your noodle about life is, you know, each of us is made of 15 trillion cells, and each cell is 15 trillion molecules. And every one of those molecules is completely inert and reacts based on the temperature and pressure and salinity and acidity gradients that it exists in. But getting back to your Kevlar question is, so what makes those Kevlar fibers so strong is the polymer which is basically the basic molecule. Basic Kevlar molecule is this rigid rod molecule, and when they form the fibers, they press it through basically a glorified shower head called a spinneret, and the way that these molecules shed all of that pressure energy is by falling into order, by falling into these beautifully aligned crystals of this Kevlar molecule.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Eric Roston is my guest. His new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. Well, on to that subtitle, let's talk about carbon fuels. What changes, Eric, when we burn a carbon-based substance?
Well, take octane. Octane is the sort of the benchmark for the energy content of gasoline. It's a molecule that's rich enough to prevent our engines from knocking. It burns cleanly, and so octane is basically a hydrocarbon of 8 carbon atoms. And what happens when you burn it? Well, it expands into a gas, and this liquid, every carbon in that molecule will bond with oxygen in the atmosphere and become CO2, and every hydrogen that's attached to the carbon in octane will become water. So you have this expanse of material. You're going from liquid to gas, and that's where we lose track of it. We no longer see it, and so it's easy to think it disappears, but it doesn't. It actually reconfigures and joins the atmosphere, where we know it can do. It has heat retention properties.
And how long does CO2 remain in the atmosphere after it's been released?
About a third of the carbon dioxide lasts about at least 500 years. Most of it comes down within 100 years or so. That's the standard thumbnail sketch the scientists will give you, but it's also good to be cognizant of the fact that the more carbon is in the atmosphere, the more those numbers will change. So two-thirds will come down after about 100 years, but, most of it, another third of it will be up there, for practical purposes, forever.
So the more there is, the longer it stays up.
Yes.
And what brings it down?
Basically, the forces of nature. Plants bring it down. And store it in their tissue. The most powerful force over geological time is actually not life related. It's basically silicate rock weathering is what scientists call it, and that's the cycle whereby basically raindrops pick up carbon dioxide on their way down to the ground, and that makes them acidic. Carbonic acid is basically seltzer water. It's part of what makes sodas acidic, and so that water that's slightly acidified will hit the rock and it'll wash away some minerals. It washes down into the ocean, settles at the bottom of the ocean. The carbon in the water mixing with the calcium becoming calcium carbonate or limestone, and from there it enters the long-term carbon cycle and begins that 200 or 300 million year journey we talked about before.
So we know that the oceans are becoming less effective as carbon sinks, and they're sort of filling up and temperatures are changing and making them less affected. You also write that if we don't change things by 2050, ecosystems that today, other ones, are absorbing carbon could actually reverse and contribute to its volume in the atmosphere. How would that happen?
Well, basically, you have the Earth subsidizes our consumption of fossil fuels by absorbing a certain amount of our industrial emissions every year. The oceans take in an enormous amount of carbon dioxide every year. Forests take in an enormous amount of carbon dioxide every year. But there are physical, chemical, and biological limitations to how much they can handle. There's a couple of studies that are of importance to that conversation. A year or two ago, scientists first started seeing that the Southern Ocean was starting to have its fill of carbon. And so when sinks, what scientists call carbon sinks, start to dry up, you know, more carbon will hang out in the atmosphere. That will cause the temperature to rise even more quickly. And that, in turn, the greater heat, you know, is predicted to unleash carbon sources from elsewhere, such as the permafrost or the extremely unlikely events of the big methane ice sheets on the continental shelf. If those come up, then it's curtains. But that's, global warming is often talked about very dramatically, and certainly it is a crisis, and it is alarming, but I really try very hard not to cross the line and be alarmist, because I prefer not to. So what I just mentioned about the methane ice sheets is something that is scientifically plausible, but extremely unlikely in any time span.
Eric Roston is my guest. His new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hello. Yes, I have a question.
Okay.
This has to do with polymers, and as a byproduct, I guess we could call it a byproduct of CO2 or carbon, what is the difference between the man-made polymer and the polymers that are, in fact, living polymers in our body? And how do those, in fact, react to one another? Or can they actually bond, or one may be toxic to the other? Or can you please elaborate on that?
That's a terrific question, and it really goes to the heart of things. There's a scientist I quote in the Carbon Age who is a plastics failure chemist, a polymer chemist, who basically has been, for his career, an expert in figuring out why plastic degrades, under what conditions, and why. And his wife became ill with cancer in the late 1990s, and it allowed him to draw the connection between our industrial synthetic polymers and the natural polymers of life. And just like he concluded, our industrial polymers, our natural polymers, which are our DNA, our hair, the keratin on tortoise shells. These are subject to the same or similar pressures and degradation that. Because, you know, they are just they're carbon polymers. I did get some feedback, actually, from some scientists get a little defensive if you call DNA a polymer because it's so complicated and does so many complicated things. But on a general level, a polymer is a long molecule with repeating chains, and both natural and unnatural and synthetic products meet that description. It's hard to get into the second part of the question. Is harder to answer because it's more. You would have to ask about specific chemicals, in terms of the interaction of natural and synthetic polymers. But certainly, On the one hand, there are dangerous combinations. On the other hand, look at our medicines, and there's an enormous synergy there too. So thank you for that question. It was a central question.
An email from Matt from Dallas asks, is your guest aware of the recent explosion of the use of HHO gas as a supplement for or a replacement for petroleum?
I am not, in fact. I know that there's the Department of Energy is putting a lot of energy, resources and work hours and energy into coming up with more efficient forms of combustion, more carbon-free forms of combustion, hydrogen combustion, and my guess would be that fits into that category, but I did not go into that specific research per se.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Evan in Dallas. Hi, Evan.
Hi. I'm just curious what the increasing use of plastics and I guess non-organic carbon forms has affected the carbon cycle. I feel like, things like trees and organic matter decay and the carbon goes back to the cycle again. But like plastic bags kind of stay plastic for a long time.
They do. And in terms of the global carbon cycle, it's probably negligible. In terms of how the Earth works and the Earth's the quantity of carbon that the Earth moves from domain to domain every year, in terms of the world we live in, however, and in terms of our landscapes and what we the type of environments we want to live in, that's where it really gets to be a danger, not only unsightly but also sometimes causing health and environmental degradation.
Eric Roston is my guest. He's a science and technology writer whose new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. We'll be back in a minute. If you want to get on the line to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Eric Roston is my guest. His new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Eric, how much progress has been made in carbon capture technologies?
That's a great question, and the answer is that carbon capture and storage technology is probably in Washington, D.C., the item of most activity, particularly in the wake of the failed climate bill earlier this summer. Basically, half of our electricity comes from burning coal, and we would like to continue burning coal because it allows everything to work. It keeps the lights on, and the optimal technology that'll get us to do that is the ability to capture carbon dioxide waste gas as it comes out of as the flues of these power plants, transported via pipeline to a geological storage site, and then just pump it underground, a mile or two underground. And there's actually there's some significant research going on at UT on this topic. The geological sequestration part is the hardest part. They haven't really pinned that yet. But it's a very hopeful technology that's getting a lot of attention and prominence here in Washington.
Would it just stay there underground, inert, or would it change in some way after being stored for centuries?
Well, I think eventually, depending on the site it's at, it would just become a part of the environment down there. Once you get down a mile or two below the surface, the gas would condense and reach a supercritical state. So it would just stay there because it wouldn't be liquid, but it would be, you know, a gas unlike any we're familiar with in our daily life, and then just sort of become a part of the rock down there.
And I guess the risk for something like that would be geologic activity and fault lines and things like that, sort of releasing this huge billow of gas.
Yeah, that's the real sticking point. Is you got to make sure it stays down there, and there are issues with every site you would want to store carbon underground. And then, you know, if they're in the event of a gas leak, then there are all sorts of other problems. Hopefully no one would be hurt in such an event, but there are liability issues, you know, physical damage, property damage. Carbon capture and storage technology won't take off unless we have probably a federally mandated price for carbon, in which case that begs the question, okay, if gas leaks, you know, who owns that carbon? Who owns that carbon dioxide? So there's really a host of scientific, technical, and legal issues that a lot of people are trying to sort out right now, both at the state and federal levels.
By the way, this is a little aside, but we call natural gas and coal and oil fossil fuels. But in fact, you found some scientific evidence that suggests that perhaps not all of them are based on carbon life forms.
We know that the Earth can make oily goop, for example, on its own. And it's pretty easy to simulate the creation of oily goop, again, for lack of a scientific word, in a laboratory. The overwhelming, the dominant historical paradigm that oil comes from sort of the decay of marine microorganisms, that still holds, but there's a really intriguing branch of research coming out of the Carnegie Institution of Washington here in D.C. and a number of other places around the country that are really testing that and saying, you know, can the Earth make pools of hydrocarbons on its own? And we know that it can happen because we see it happen here in small batches. And just astonishingly, Titan, one of Saturn's moons, is basically a hydrocarbon planet. So this is an interest of an increasing number of scientists now, and receiving a lot of attention. Sort of inconclusive at this point, but it's a very exciting field to watch.
Next on the line to speak to you, Eric Roston, author of The Carbon Age, we have Hunter in Irving. Hello, Hunter.
Hi there. I had a question about the carbon in our bodies, and basically, well, in every organism on the planet. If those cells have carbon in them and are constantly dividing, require more carbon. Where's that carbon coming from? Is it from the being reclaimed from other sources like food or someplace else?
That's exactly right. It's carbon is what's for dinner, and the carbon we take in from our environment as food is analogous to what cells in our bodies or bacteria living in gold mines 2 miles under South Africa. Are doing. Every living thing needs to get its carbon from somewhere in its environment, and that comes in forms, depending on the species and the conditions. But I think you actually came pretty close there to answering the question inside the question.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have John in Denton. Hi, John.
Yeah. Hi. How are you today?
Great. Thanks.
Good. I wonder if your guest has heard of this company out in West Texas that is making gasoline and making diesel fuel out of algae and water. They claim that they, by taking 10% of the area of New Mexico, they can actually make all the fuel the country needs for 1 year.
It is such an exciting time to look, to be in the energy business, and I'm not familiar with the specific company in West Texas that you're talking about, but I may be, actually. I'm not sure. But there is there's so much activity. In Chapter 11 of The Carbon Age, I talk about the coming synthesis of industry and biology. And algae reactors, it sounds very sort of science fiction, but, you know, why not have life do our work for us? And it's just every day you open the newspaper or see a new study about a potential energy technology, and that's one of the more particularly intriguing ones.
It is funny that this West Texas company assumes that they'll use land in New Mexico to grow all this algae.
There's some tradition in the sort of the energy business of, you know, cordoning off parts of Western states just as a sort of a thought experiment. So it probably comes out of, you know, years of proponents of solar power saying, you know, if we take this much, you know, square miles of Nevada or New Mexico, then we can solve all our problems. You know, of course, you got to string, you know, transmission wires from there to Maine, but there is that's a sort of a traditional metric. Probably also comes out of, you know, Los Alamos being in New Mexico and that being a center of energy research for a long time.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next to Gary in Fort Worth. Hi, Gary.
Yes, you may have addressed this, but let me ask it anyway. You mentioned that that carbon came from stars, and there's a theory that's accepted more in Europe than in here about that all the hydrocarbons were formed at the same time the planet was. And so consequently, they definitely are not from animal and vegetable. But what's your idea on that?
Well, I think when petrogeologists look for oil, one of the things they look for is are hydrocarbons that are clearly descended from biological molecules. So basically, molecules you would find in a marine zooplankton that's been degraded by time. So I think there's definitely, you can say, that enormous quantity of our fossil fuels are of biological in origin. And there's a lot of research going on now to figure out how much of the gas, natural gas, how much of the oil is abiotic or non-biological in origin. But I think the jury's still out, even though we know it's possible.
Eric, last year the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that CO2 is a pollutant, and that means the EPA has a right to regulate it. Of course, we know that the right and the responsibility are two different things. Do you expect that decision to yield any major turnaround in U.S. policy?
The biggest turnaround in U.S. policy will be brought by the presidential election this year. This administration hasn't shown any interest in dealing with the climate crisis and has thrown up barriers at every opportunity, and most recently, as a result of that very Supreme Court decision, the Bush EPA basically punted a couple weeks ago, saying, in a regulatory, administrative, bureaucratic format, saying we're not going to deal with this. We're going to wait for the next administration to do so. And both campaigns have been, in some ways, trying to outgreen each other.
Can you give us a quick comparison of how close John McCain and Barack Obama's proposals are for emissions regulation?
It depends where, what altitude you want to look at. If you want to look at, sort of treat it as a normal policy conversation, then and if your criterion for analysis is being aggressive on global warming, then Obama has a tougher limit he wants to reach. He wants to reduce our carbon emissions by 80%, which is a larger number than McCain's pledged proposal, which would take us down 66%. McCain also has made some statements in the last couple months indicating that he's not as wedded to the fundamental policy tool that we would need to get these changes, which would be a mandatory carbon cap on industrial emissions. So that's one level of analysis. Another level of analysis is you look at the science, you look at the rate at which the atmosphere is changing and the world is warming and ice is melting, And you realize that there's really not a proposal anywhere that is a sure thing to get us out of this pickle we've put ourselves in. So, yes, there are differences, definable differences between the candidates, but also it's good to keep in mind that, you know, even the most aggressive ones are still, you know, sort of shrink in comparison with the problem.
One thing that you think might make a critical difference is, had we required university students, even before now, and particularly science students, to study geochemistry? That's not a common field of study today?
I think it's not. I think, you know, maybe this is just anecdotal. But let me tell you this story. There's a half a dozen things or so I thought about every day in the course of my research. One of them was just a magazine teaser. You know, a teaser is just the thing on the front cover that gets you inside the magazine. The teaser was, guess what the hottest crop of a science book is? Here's a hint, it's not geology. And so you flip in, and just a couple years ago it was a review of Freakonomics and a couple of the other very popular and successful economics books. But, you know, that crystallized something very fundamental for me and something very fundamental about the carbon age and why I wanted to write it, which is that economics is wholly dependent on geology. You know, we think of geology as this, you know, very sort of academic, removed, ivory tower discipline where guys with beards go to Australia and Wyoming and, you know, chip away at rocks for 40 years. But the fact is our entire economy is based on the excavation of carbon minerals and their burning into atmospheric gas. So I just wonder, and this is chapter 10 of the carbon age, you know, in 20 years and 40 years, what are people going to say looking back at this powerful, you know, technological civilization we have that somehow, you know, doesn't make the connection that there are and have been repercussions of, you know, having an economy based on geology and not really recognizing it. So that's one thing I throw out there and ask people to consider.
And changing our behavior is critical, but it will never be enough, you say, until we really, really change public policy.
I think that, you know, you hear a lot of talk traditionally about personal conservation and personal responsibility. We're now living in a time where civic responsibility and civic activity has to be built into our definition of personal responsibility, because the only way things are going to change are for people to lead, because we've seen this conversation now go on for 20 years in Washington with almost nothing to show for it.
Eric Roston is a science and technology writer. His new book is called The Carbon Age, How Life's Core Element Has Become Civilization's Greatest Threat. His website is thecarbonage.com. Eric, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.